When I started, the word cybersecurity didn't even exist. It was just this, you know, thing I did because people would pay me for it. In fact, when the word cybersecurity came out, I was like, well, that'll never stick. That sounds silly. And here we are today.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. How does the CEO of Missoula, Montana's LMG Security spend her workdays? By finding ways to break into companies, then writing reports about it. Meet author, lecturer, and security badass Sherry Davidoff. In the cyber sleuthing world, Davidoff's codename is Alien, and she's the subject of a new book called Breaking and Entering. Sherry outed herself last year as Alien, and she's begun sharing her adventures in the world of data breaches and digital forensics. She's influenced by the tradition of white hat hacking of her alma mater, MIT, where passwords and even locked doors are rendered irrelevant. As cybersecurity warfare keeps escalating, Sherry's 10-year-old company, LMG Security, is sought by the likes of Google, Comcast, and the Department of Defense. On this week's Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, listen and learn about data privacy and the breaking of glass ceilings with my guest, Sherry Davidoff. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communications solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome, Sherry Davidoff. We have a lot to talk about.
We do.
Up until recently, you were the closest thing that we had in Missoula, Montana to a clandestine business superstar. Why did you out yourself?
Well, I don't think I'm very clandestine to begin with. I mean, if you're going to run a business and have clients around the world but be based in Montana, you got to work really hard to market and to get your name out and to build relationships other places. But I think what you're referring to is the book that just came out, Breaking and Entering, correct?
Yes.
So yeah, this is a book about my life as a hacker by Jeremy N. Smith. Fantastic book, by the way. And yeah, it was a very surreal experience for me. I care a lot about privacy as a privacy geek and a cybersecurity professional. And so it was a scary experience to undertake that and be written about. And I thought I was going to be anonymous. In fact, I was absolutely sure about it. And then I realized in June that it was possible to Google like three things about the book and figure out that it was me. So over a period of a few months, I finally decided, okay, well, the story's out there and I'm going to own it. And yeah, it's been a real pleasure to connect with people.
So for our listeners, the book you're referring to is Breaking and Entering. How do you now feel that it's in the public domain?
Well, honestly, it's been a big relief because I spent the past few years wondering, like, what's going to happen now that all the details of my life as a hacker are out there? And the reception has been amazing. So many people have come out of the woodwork, a lot of women in technology, a lot of fellow business people. They've come out. They've been super supportive. People from my past, from college, my mentors have come and been really supportive. So that's been great.
And you're more than a hacker. So tell our listeners what LMG Security does.
Sure. Well, we're a small cybersecurity consulting firm. We break into companies and write reports about it. And then if a company gets hacked, we come in, we get them cleaned up, we handle the investigation. These days, the cybersecurity industry has evolved a lot. So we also do a lot of compliance work now that there are cybersecurity regulations. We do training. We are a full service cybersecurity firm. We work around the world and we are based here in Montana because Montana is beautiful and awesome.
And how'd you get here?
Well, what happened actually was I was based in Boston and a bank got hacked and I was put on that investigation. It was a fascinating investigation, an international case actually. So it involved flying to Europe and sneaking around office buildings, imaging hard drives, and then we brought them all back to Boston and we worked in a forensics lab for weeks. And so they sent another consultant out and he was from Montana and we fell in love and moved out here. And so I'm here.
I've read the book. It's fascinating. How did you come up with your alias Alien?
You know, my father used to refer to me as E.T. My middle initials are E.T. So when I was in college, he would always say, E.T., phone home. And when I sat down at MIT for the first time in front of a computer prompt, they prompt you for your username. And the default is like S. Davidoff, for example. And I was like, well, that's boring. I'll put an E.T. And they said, too short. And then I was like, well, let me try Alien. And what I didn't realize is that MIT does not allow you to change your username ever. It's kind of like your social security number in some ways. So that was it. With that one moment, I was stuck with that for my life. And I'm happy that I was because it's worked out.
At MIT, you are a member of the infamous Coffee House Club. So tell our listeners what the Coffee House Club is.
Sure. The Coffee House Club was not quite as formal as it might sound. Really, it was just a loose group of hackers that would get together Saturday nights at midnight. You'd meet in the 24-hour coffee house. There was a pool table in the back. And so we'd get together and just sort of decide, hey, where do you want to go tonight? For us, MIT was our playground. I used to wander around in my pajamas all the time. It was just like this giant living room because we lived right there on campus. And in the hallways, there's like big containers of chemicals and lasers that people are giving away and all kinds of stuff. But we would roam around and explore the buildings, which had been constructed over, you know, many, many years. So we would find interstitial spaces. We would climb the elevator shafts. We found there was one place where there was a shower that was buried deep inside the building that had been all bricked up. And you could only get there by climbing through the interstitial space. So we would just meet on Saturday nights and say, hey, where do you want to go? And then see if anyone knew how to get there. And if not, we would explore.
And you actually hacked into some of those buildings.
Physically, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And there's different hacking groups. So my hacking group was Jack Flory, old number 5, 5th East. And we would, you know, I remember just the week I got there, people told me how to use a slide and how to card a door. And we had little hacking cards. So you learn the basics of breaking and entering pretty quickly.
Among all the things that you've done in the 16 years since MIT, what prepared you the most for what you're doing now?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of variety in my life, to do many different things. So I've worked at a hospital, and that was absolutely eye-opening. I think that was actually the most helpful, because at a hospital, I started working there right when HIPAA first came out, when cybersecurity laws first started coming out, and we had to train people. And that's really the intersection where technical and people skills intersect. And that's a really important skill to learn. So I think that was a really formative experience. And then in terms of running a business, I come from a family of small business owners. And from the time I was a little girl, my dad would take me to small business conferences at my mom's store. Like, they put me to work. I still have my first paycheck from my grandfather for 60 cents. I worked 12 hours. And so just working there at the family business helped a lot.
Do you think that you chose this career, or did it choose you?
Yeah, I definitely didn't choose this career. I kept thinking, what do I want to do with my life? I've been thinking that for 18 years now. And along the way, I'm just doing security to make money. And eventually I realized, wow, this has become an industry. Because when I started, it wasn't, the word cybersecurity didn't even exist. It was just this thing I did because people would pay me for it. In fact, when the word cybersecurity came out, I was like, well, that'll never stick. That sounds silly. And here we are today.
When you were at MIT, most of what you're dealing with now didn't even exist. So how do you keep up with what's going on?
Honestly, it's funny how the problems are still the same. In some ways, it hasn't changed that much. You know, the big problems are still people aren't keeping their software up to date, and so their systems get hacked. They click on links. Passwords are huge. Weak passwords are a huge problem. And these are the exact same problems we had 20 years ago. Part of the reason for that is that as a society, we have not implemented all the security technologies that we can or should on purpose, because our businesses and our government want to be able to read your email. And so we don't have all the security technologies in place that we could.
You've been quoted as saying, "Passwords are dead to me."
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I mean, I've been saying for years, passwords are passe. Your password has been stolen. I mean, let's be honest. You probably have a lot of passwords that have been stolen. They are out there. Google did a paper last year and found 2 billion passwords just floating around on the dark web, getting sold and traded by hackers. Chances are your password has already been stolen. And if it hasn't, you need to treat it like it's going to be stolen. So we need, as a society, we need to start thinking about other ways to verify people's identities besides passwords. The same things that make passwords great, the fact that they're free, the fact that they're easy to distribute, also make them really easy to steal.
What are those other things that could replace passwords?
Well, two-factor authentication is huge. And let me back up a second here. Authentication is a big word. So when I say authentication, I mean this is how we verify someone's identity. And in security, we say that there's three ways to verify someone's identity: with something you know, like a password, something you have. So if you go to the airport, how do you verify your identity? driver's license, right? Or you can use your phone, like a code on your phone. So that's something you have, or something you are, like a fingerprint and or your eyeball, an iris scanner, something like that. So something you know, something you have, something you are. And these days, it's really important to use two-factor authentication. That means using more than one method of verifying your identity. Because assume your password is out there. The only way to make sure that a hacker in Russia can't log into your account is use some second method.
How long would it take you to hack into a typical email account?
It honestly depends on the person that uses it. You can send a phishing email, especially crafted phishing email, and they might click on it and I could steal their password. And depending on the person, that might take one try, 30 seconds, or maybe they're really good and I have to spend a while working on it. So it's all about the human brain.
You've also said that by 2020, there'll be 30 billion connected devices with no security management. What does that mean for our listeners, and what should we be concerned about?
So the statistic you're quoting, Arnie, is that by 2020, we estimate that there will be 30 billion devices connected to the internet. And that includes things like cars and smartwatches and smart coffee pots and your refrigerator and things like that. And the problem is that the vendors that make those, they're not always maintaining those devices. They're not installing software patches. And so these things get vulnerable. Or sometimes they're using default passwords. So maybe your refrigerator has a password of refrigerator and the criminals can guess that. And there might be no way for you to change that. So that means that all of these devices, not all of them, a lot of these devices are just sitting ducks, waiting for hackers to come along and break into them.
And then you get that email message saying, if you want your refrigerator to continue to work, you have to pay us $700 or something along those lines, right?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because that's what you're referring to is ransomware, where criminals break into your computer and they throw up a note and they hold it for ransom. And that's easier when there's some kind of display that criminals can show a note on. So if your smart fridge has some kind of display, they might be able to display something that says, hey, pay us, 10 Bitcoin and you can have your fridge back. That's a lot of money. So probably less than that for the home user. I worry a lot about commercial buildings being held hostage. So imagine a skyscraper where the HVAC system gets shut down and held for ransom, or the lighting system. This has the potential to be hugely disruptive. We just saw recently the city of Allentown had their network taken over by a banking Trojan, and it infected not just their normal workstations, but it also infected their security camera network. And so that's just an example of where our devices, our Internet of Things devices, are being taken over. It's not just your workstations anymore.
I've read about a hospital in which they've been asked ransom from them, or they were going to destroy all the patient records.
Yeah, and that happens more than you might think. Most of the time when companies are held for ransom, it doesn't make the news, because who's going to report this to the news, But yeah, we've seen a lot of cases like that. And it's organizations that depend on operations, hospitals, transportation companies, places like that, that are the biggest targets.
So some of the biggest companies around, Equifax, Facebook, Quora, Starwood, have had major data breaches. What's the best way for those companies to protect themselves, besides hiring you? What's the best way for them to protect themselves?
Well, I'm going to detour for a second, because the word data breach is fascinating. The term is fascinating. And it did not exist until 2005. So until I was 5 years into my career, and then people started talking about data breaches. Remember that data breaches is a legal term, and it only pertains to certain types of data. So when Equifax got hacked, you saw these headlines that said 143 million Americans have lost their social security numbers. For me, as a security geek, the first thing I thought was, well, what else was hacked? Right? Because your social security number is legally protected. But Equifax does a lot of other things. These companies do things like they might have web surfing histories. Equifax does digital onboarding. So they will connect your shopping habits with your online persona so that a retailer can target you with advertisements while you're surfing. And you can tell a lot from somebody's web surfing or shopping history. You can tell what kind of diseases they have, if they're having an affair, if they're going through a divorce, and then they can exploit that and market to you. So my question is, okay, Equifax, what else got stolen? And we may never know those things. There are lots of companies that have very sensitive information stolen, but they are not legally required to tell us. And for me, that's frightening.
You're one of the few women in this industry. How do you get young women to be interested in science and computers?
Well, I think a lot of young women are interested in science and computers. There's a couple challenges. One is that we need more women to be visible role models. Like when I go and teach at major conferences, I teach a class called Data Breaches, for example, at Black Hat USA, and we'll have maybe 50 people in the class and two or three of them are women. And the nice thing is that number has gone up a little bit over the past few years. And I think the more women are out there, the more of us are, that are speaking and really being visible, then the more women will feel like they can join this industry, that they're not being excluded from it and they feel more comfortable. Also, just working with women when they're younger, working with girls in high schools, trying to get them involved in technology groups at a younger age, I think is really important. But I'm really a big proponent of gender balance. I think it's important for men and women to be recognized in the space, because by promoting women, we don't want men to feel excluded either. So just promoting that gender balance and changing the culture is key.
So how do you overcome the male mindset in the industry?
What do you mean the male mindset?
Well, the industry is pretty dominated by men.
Yeah.
And women are breaking in. You're one of the people that broke the glass ceiling, so to speak.
Yep.
So when you're out there at conferences, events, working in training, is there something specifically that you do to try to reach gender balance or to try to promote gender balance?
Yeah, again, I mean, just being visible is very important. I think it can be intimidating for women to be in a group of 5 or 10 or 15 men and be the only one and you feel a little different. And so I would just encourage all the women out there to embrace being different. It can be absolutely both a blessing and a curse. And so let's try to approach it as an opportunity.
What do you find the most interesting part of your job these days?
Ooh, Arnie, that is a great question. You know, I love the technical side of things, but I have to say, now that I'm a CEO of two different companies, I really enjoyed developing the business. And the cybersecurity industry changes so quickly. You know, we see new regulations emerge constantly. Recently, we saw banking trojans become an epidemic. I would say I really love watching what our forensics team is doing and seeing how the different breaches and hacks are evolving, because they're on the front lines. Our forensics team is on the front lines every single day. And so they see the latest malware. They see what it's doing. What we just saw this past week was a new kind of malware we hadn't seen before. And it is stealing people's Office 365 tokens and bypassing two-factor authentication. And that's pretty scary. That's like the next step. That's going to undermine some of our tactics for securing accounts. And so I think that's fascinating.
I'm speaking with Sherry Davidoff, who's CEO of LMG Security, but you also mentioned a second company that you're CEO of, which is Brightwise. Tell us about that company.
Yep. So Brightwise, that's bright-wise.com. We have partnered on this joint venture with an organization out of Des Moines that we've worked with a lot. We provide cybersecurity training in little bite-sized chunks. So animated videos about how to manage your passwords and how to manage phishing emails and how to defend yourself against hackers. We've been doing training at LMG for many years, and we just had such a demand. And I thought to myself, I can't be on airplanes all the time. We have to find a way to reach people quickly and efficiently and on your schedule, on the schedule of all the employees at a hospital, rather than trying to get organizations to have everybody in an auditorium all at once. So that's what we do. We provide online virtual training that's animated and fun. So check us out.
As a cyber sleuth doing digital forensic, you have developed a particular set of skills. So how did you transfer those skills into running a company?
So the skills required for digital forensics in some ways do overlap with running a company. You need that attention to detail. And the skills for doing digital forensics are different from the skills that you need to break into companies. To break into companies, you need to think outside the box. You need to be creative. To do digital forensics, you really need to be checking checkboxes and looking for those little clues and following the trail in a way that is very much reproducible if possible. So those are two different skill sets. Honestly, I think running a company requires a third type of skill set. And a lot of that comes from working in my parents' businesses as a child.
You have 30 people working for you here in Missoula. How did you recruit them?
I feel like we've had the good fortune of collecting amazing people over a period of 10 years. And in a lot of cases, people have found us and sought us out because obviously there's not a whole lot of cybersecurity companies in our region. We also work very closely with the University of Montana and the Missoula College. So I've been an adjunct in both the School of Business and the Computer Science Department. And so we've had the opportunity to work with them in terms of, you know, what education is appropriate, what's practical for the field. And that's allowed us to get in front of the students and to build relationships with them.
And I'm correct that many of your senior staff are women.
That's correct. Yeah, we do have a strong population of women at LMG. It's not something that's happened on purpose. Perhaps it's just because as women, we've been visible. And so women who are interested in that type of culture come to us. We also have men represented. I like to think that we have a culture of equality, and that's really important.
You're in a competitive industry and you secure global clients. How do you recruit them from Missoula, Montana?
Getting clients in Montana certainly has been a challenge over the years because you have to work extra hard to get your name out. You know, we don't have the luxury of going to these big networking events all the time in New York or Seattle or places like that. So it's been a combination of tactics. Number one, I think it's really important to do cutting edge research, to get attention, to be on that bleeding edge. Also, we provide real value to our clients. We provide Montana quality customer service. We care about people. We care about that long-term relationship with our clients. And so when we get a client, they stick around. And over time, we've accumulated a client base. So that's been extremely helpful as well.
But initially, there was probably a bias about going to Silicon Valley or New York or the big cities. And how could this group in Missoula have the capability that some of the bigger market companies might have?
Absolutely. I get the question all the time, why should I hire a company based out of Montana? To which I say, number one, we believe in excellence, excellent quality of service, and it's something that our whole team believes in. We are employee owned, and so our team members have a vested interest in the company. That's very unusual. In cybersecurity, there's a lot of churn. A lot of other companies have people coming and going and coming and going. And we care for all of our clients, our VIP clients, and we treat them that way, whether they're a small business or a big business.
Let me throw out a few words to you and get your reaction. ATMs.
Oh, I love ATMs.
What's their place in the world of security?
So ATMs are a beautiful thing. ATMs are important for historic reasons because they are probably the first example in your life where you used two-factor authentication. So the first ATMs came out in the mid-60s, and when you first used an ATM, they came out in Britain, and you would go to your bank. Originally, you would go to your bank on a Friday and say, I'm going to want to withdraw 50 quid over the weekend, and they would give you a punch card, and you would go to the newfangled ATM on Saturday and put your punch card in and take out your 50 quid. And of course, if you lost your punch card, what happens? Well, somebody else would pick it up and take your 50 quid. And so they started to think, aha, we need pins in addition to this thing that we have. Some people pushed back on that, of course, as we do. But think about how you feel about having a pin with your ATM card today, right? You feel pretty darn good about it. And right now we see history repeating itself. People are like, oh, I don't want a pin or a passcode when I'm typing my password into my bank account. Well, 20 years from now, people will say, I can't believe my bank doesn't give me a pin along with my password, you know, just like ATMs.
The Internet of Things.
So the Internet of Things is just a way of talking about all the little devices we have, the smartwatches, the coffee pots, all those things that are getting connected to the internet. And the Internet of Things has existed for a long time. Like when I worked at the Children's Hospital, we had all kinds of equipment that was connected to the network. But now that equipment is something that you can see as an end consumer. It's all these little gadgets and devices. And so then the question becomes, well, who manages those devices? Because as a consumer, you don't have time to worry about, well, is my watch secure? And is my coffee pot secure? And what if my coffee pot is attacking my neighbor? What about my smart lighting system? So right now, as an industry, we don't have a good way of securing all those devices, but we need to start demanding better security from the manufacturers and vendors.
Cryptocurrency.
So perhaps we should back up and define this. Cryptocurrency is digital cash. I'll talk about it first in the context of crime, although I want to say cryptocurrency is a tool. So like any tool, it can be used for good and it can be used for evil. Your car can be used for good or evil. Your guns can be used for good or evil. Same thing with cryptocurrency. But cryptocurrency is only popular, frankly, because of crime. Back in the day, like when TJ Maxx was hacked, for example, Albert Gonzalez, who was the mastermind behind that, he would sell credit card numbers to people in Europe, and his folks in Europe would get packages of cash and send them to him. So he was receiving cash. Or a lot of other cyber criminals were getting payments through PayPal or other methods. And the problem for them was that they were getting tracked down and put in jail. So cryptocurrency provides us with anonymous online transactions so that you can send somebody money and it can't, in theory, be traced back to you. And so this was really big. It revolutionized the cybercrime industry. And because it became popular in that context, we were also able to use that in the legitimate economy as well.
Social media privacy. Is there such a thing?
I don't think there is. If you use social media, you should understand that everything you do is being tracked. I'm a big proponent of privacy. Montana is one of two states in the nation that has privacy protected in our Constitution. But right now, your data is out there and companies are mining it. Again, I think we really need to push to regulate how it is being used, because you should know exactly what's being tracked about you, or you should be able to find out, and you should have some say over how it's being used.
Artificial intelligence.
This is like a psychiatry exam. I feel like you're going to show me. Are you going to show me Rorschach blots?
When the show's over.
Bring out the ink blots. Artificial intelligence. What do you want to know?
I want to know about the cybersecurity aspect of protection around artificial intelligence.
Sure. I mean, I am not an artificial intelligence expert, first of all. I can say that AI is really important in cybersecurity because there are so many threats like viruses and worms that are programmed to constantly evolve. Like literally the viruses evolve. They're polymorphic. They're changing, so they're hard to detect. And so we need AI in order to evolve. We need AI in order to have protection that evolves with the threats, because the human mind cannot squash every virus that comes into your network.
I want to back up to like a 30,000 foot view and ask you, how confident are you that we can get Russia, Chinese, North Korean hackers, media manipulators, you know, in general, under control?
Well, I mean, it's kind of, I don't think any of this will ever be fully under control. Remember, the United States does the same things. So any major player is going to be investing in a cyber warfare or cyber manipulation program. That's just where we're at. We need our population to be educated, and we need to try to make things as transparent as possible.
What do companies get wrong about security?
Oh, well, we've seen the same problems over and over again over the years. You got to patch your systems. A lot of companies are not patching their systems. A big thing that companies get wrong is assuming that people will pick good passwords and remember them. And the human brain is not designed to remember a bazillion different passwords with numbers and letters and squirrel noises and all kinds of complicated stuff. So you really have to give people tools if you want them to pick good passwords, like a secure password manager that's going to generate and store them for you. You need to give people tools for two-factor authentication and teach them how to use it. You can't just give people that burden of figuring it all out on their own, because as much as you'd like to pass the buck on responsibility, really companies need to take the time to give people the tools they need and to train them.
In general, what concerns you about how technology is evolving?
I have concerns about privacy. The big thing that concerns me is the ways that we as a society have undermined security that are invisible to the general consumer, to people like you. So, for example, your email could have been encrypted. You know, we could have real encrypted email, but we don't, because our government wants to be able to monitor our email. Businesses want to be able to monitor your email. And so as a society, we did not install strong security mechanisms that we could have. And we are paying the price. For example, if we had real email encryption in place, then when, you know, the Clinton campaign got hacked, the content of those emails would not have been visible. All those phishing emails you receive, there are actually secure and strong and effective ways for you to verify who an email really comes from. But that technology has not been deployed, because that same technology can be used, again, to put your email in an envelope and prevent prying eyes from seeing it. So as a society, we've made a choice. Businesses want to be able to read your email. The government wants to be able to read your email. And as a result, we are far less secure. And consumers don't know that. And therefore, consumers have not demanded it.
So how often when you walk in the office is a surprise waiting for you?
Every day. And often there's multiple surprises. So, for example, just a couple weeks ago, I got a phone call from our office saying, hey, a city's under attack. They've been held hostage for ransomware. Our guys are flying out there. And we have been named in the media. And that's a challenge for us as a firm, because our clients' confidentiality is extremely important to us. And if we're starting to get phone calls from the media, we have to make sure that everybody is prepared to handle that. So we have a very strong method for approaching the media. But again, that's something that I as a CEO need to be aware of in case I get media requests. It's something that the client needs to be aware of, although usually they're the ones that have spoken to the media to begin with. And then, of course, there's just the fact of us working with whatever city it is to help them out and recover them. There's the details of the investigation. A lot of times we're working with law enforcement. We might be working with the FBI, and this might be part of a bigger investigation because the same people that hacked that city might have hacked other cities. And so we need to be coordinating on a broader front.
So what's the future look like for Sherry Davidoff?
For me, I don't think I can see into the future. I can tell you that every day I walk into the office, something unexpected happens. And I imagine that the world will continue to operate that way and that every day something unexpected will happen and I'll just keep rolling with it.
Sherry, I'm very much looking forward to reading your new book, Data Breaches, when it comes out and seeing what the future holds for all of us from the cybersecurity world. Thank you for being on the show. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you, Arnie. It's been a real privilege.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time to Can Do when our guest will be Mallory Otariano, founder of Kind Apparel, recycled plastic adventure-ready wearables. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communications solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com.